on the declaration printed on the ballot's return envelope. The department said in the lawsuit that the handwritten date is not necessary for any purpose, does not remedy any mischief, and does not advance any other objective, and that allowing just three county boards to exclude votes that all other county boards have included in their returns creates impermissible discrepancies in the administration of Pennsylvania's 2022 primary election. The Pennsylvania Department of State's lawsuit said interpreting Pennsylvania's law to allow a county board of election to exclude a ballot from its final certified results because of a minor and meaningless irregularity, such as a voter omitting a date from the declaration on a timely received ballot, would fail to fulfill the purpose of the Pennsylvania Election Code and would risk a conflict with both the Pennsylvania Constitution and federal laws. Molly Stiber, a spokeswoman for the State Attorney General Josh Shapiro, told the New York Times, "It is imperative that every legal vote cast by a qualified voter is counted," adding, "The 64 other counties in Pennsylvania have complied and accurately certified their election results. Counties cannot abuse their responsibility for running elections as an excuse to unlawfully disenfranchise voters." Berks County Commissioner Christian Leinbach said during an appearance in court on Thursday, 28th of July, that he does not have discretion to determine whether a date is material or immaterial. Claiming that rulings on the ballots have been anything but clear, he said during a hearing, "I simply am obliged to look at the clear language of the law that says undated and or unsigned ballots will not be counted." Christian Leinbach said he could not in good conscience vote to certify undated ballots, claiming that this type of issue is what is causing a lack of trust in the system. Lancaster County officials told the Philadelphia Inquirer the county had properly certified its results in accordance with state law and court orders. The county said, "The Commonwealth's demand is contrary to the law or any existing court order. The county will vigorously defend its position to follow the law to ensure the integrity of elections in Lancaster County." According to the Associated Press, Fayette County officials argued in a court filing that the state did not have the authority to force it to count the undated ballots, adding that the state had missed the deadline to appeal a county board decision. The county also cited ongoing litigation before the Supreme Court, which has yet to rule on the merits of the appellate court ruling. It's unclear which way the Supreme Court may rule. Only Justices Samuel Alito, Clarence Thomas, and Neil Gorsuch dissented in the earlier emergency order, arguing that the lower court ruling was very likely wrong. The American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, defended the appellate court ruling after Samuel Alito's dissent. ACLU attorney Ari Savitsky said in a statement, "Every vote matters and every valid vote should be counted. Voters may not be disenfranchised for a minor paperwork error like this one." The Third Circuit was correct in unanimously reaching that conclusion. "We are thrilled for these votes that their ballots can finally now be counted, consistent with the requirements of federal law." Matthew Weil, the director of the Elections Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center, said in a statement the dates on the absentee ballot envelopes neither help determine whether a voter is eligible nor whether the ballot was cast by the deadline. He said, exploiting inconsequential errors or omissions to invalidate otherwise eligible ballots received by the deadline is poor policy and bad for democracy. The fact that the state already accepts ballots with incorrect or invalid dates only demonstrates how inconsequential this requirement is to determine the voters' and the ballot's eligibility. Democratic election lawyer Mark Elias warned that the situation in Pennsylvania is far more disturbing than those we have seen elsewhere. Mark Elias noted that the three counties have a combined population of over 1 million people, and the issue causing the counties to contest the results has been fully litigated in both federal and state courts. He said, most importantly, these counties did not refuse to submit any election results at all. Worse, they submitted results that intentionally exclude lawful votes, adding that this is how Republicans are planning to steal elections in the future. Nonpartisan election law experts agreed that the trend could cause chaos on a larger scale. Robert Yablon, a law professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School, told the New York Times, had this unfolded on this kind of timeline in 2020, it really could have created problems because there would have been questions about whether the state could have actually named a slate of electors. Robert Yablon added, you could imagine there being disputed slates of electors that were sent to Congress, and it could have been a big mess.
The story of Masoud and Saddam.
Part 2.
Upon his arrival in Iraq in 1986, Masoud Rajavi was received warmly by the ruling Ba'ath Party. It was at this point that Saddam Hussein and Masoud Rajavi started a lifelong friendship, one that heralded a new chapter for the Iraqi people. At the time, no one could even imagine that the presence of a terrorist organization headed by Masoud Rajavi would have such disastrous consequences for the Iraqi citizens. Shoring up Rajavi's fragile group and providing him with military facilities to establish a small but independent army on Iraqi soil, Saddam Hussein was in fact helping Rajavi fulfill his dream of becoming the president of Iran. But Rajavi's assault to take Tehran was a non-starter. His army was dealt heavy losses in what Iran called Operation Mursad. This was the last major military operation of the Iran-Iraq War, ending in a decisive victory for Iran. Unable to take Tehran, the defeated army had to remain in Iraq, an albatross around the neck of the Ba'ath Party. As the Iraqi war in Iran drew to an end with no significant achievement for the Iraqi strongmen, signs of despair and distrust began to bubble up in the rank and file of the Ba'ath army, bringing the country to the verge of a revolt against Saddam Hussein's dictatorship. But the dictator's scheme saved his power. At Saddam Hussein's order, The Ba'ath military camps received Rajavi's group between 1988 and 1991. The aim was to give the MKO members special military training with modern weapons. At the time, no one knew when and where the training and the weapons would be used. Not only did the Mujahideen Khalq organization resemble the Ba'ath Party in appearance, also efforts were made to inculcate into the members the idea that ordinary people would be enemy number one for them. On August 2, 1990, Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. He wanted to compensate for heavy losses he had incurred in his 8-year-old war on Iran, and also to find a way out for the country's deteriorating economy. But the dictator made miscalculations. All his once Western and Arab supporters stood against him. He was doomed to defeat in this war as well. On March 3, 1991, one day after the Persian Gulf War ceasefire, a T-72 tank gunner, returning home after Iraq's defeat in Kuwait, fired a shell into a colossal portrait of Saddam Hussein hanging over Basra's main square. The revolt in Basra was first led by Colonel Mohammad Ibrahim Wali, an Iraqi army officer. He attacked some government buildings and prisons in the city. Backed by a majority of the population, the uprising led to the fall of Basra into the hands of the dissidents. On the same day, in Najaf, a demonstration near Imam Ali Mosque became a gun battle between army deserters and Saddam's security forces. People seized control of the city. The uprising spread within days to all of the big Shia cities in South Iraq. Amara, Diwaniya, Hilla, Karbala, Kut, Nasiriyah, and Samawa. Now, the initial protests had turned into a widespread uprising in which both Shia and Sunni Muslims stood side by side against the dictatorship of Saddam Hussein. 3 days after the start of the uprising in the south, which was also referred to as the Sha'ban Intifada due to its concurrence with the month of Sha'ban, another wave of insurgency broke out in the Kurdish-populated areas in the north. The situation had spun out of control. The intelligence service and the army seemed impotent in the face of such big an event. The dictator was in danger of collapse. But one thing changed the course of history. The so-called National Liberation Army of Iran, commanded by Masoud Rajavi, an army Saddam Hussein had long counted on. When the uprising began, Masoud Rajavi was located in a base called Light One in Karbala. The fall of Saddam Hussein meant the fall of him and his organization. Soon after, he deployed his task forces to Basra to infiltrate the people so as to identify the leaders of the uprising. Along with a number of his intelligence agents, Masoud headed for Camp Ashraf in Diyala, in the north of Baghdad. Because they were Iranian nationals, the MKO members could go freely among the ordinary people and revolutionaries. Therefore, they handed in the names of prominent revolutionaries along with their addresses to the Iraqi intelligence service, known also as the Mukhabarat. Within a short span of time, the leaders of the revolution were arrested and sentenced to death in the worst ways possible, including throwing off a height, beheading, being cut into pieces in big industrial meat grinders, being dissolved in sulfuric acid, and being blown up with TNT in their pockets. Those killed during the uprisings were among the luckiest. The other group had a fate worse than death. They were subjected to brutal tortures. Their fate had to be a salutary lesson. Breaking arms and fingers were among the simplest tortures in the Ba'ath prisons during the crackdown on the 1991 uprisings in Iraq. All that was possible with the help of Saddam Hussein's private army. That's the MKO, headed by Masoud Rajavi. The help the MKO gave Saddam Hussein was not limited to identifying the leaders of the 1991 uprisings. After the suppression of the uprisings, they paved the way for the Ba'ath army to enter the city of Karbala. In the conflict between the people and the MKO forces in Karbala, three forces who were among MKO's special agents were killed by the people. These three were later buried in Marvarid Ashraf Cemetery. The three were the whole casualties of the MKO during the 1991 uprisings. But there are still thousands of people unaccounted for. They disappeared during the uprisings. Years later, 3 days after the fall of Saddam Hussein, the faint glimmer of hope to find them blew out, as there was nothing to be found about them in the remaining documents in Abu Ghraib prison. The discovered mass graves only revealed the fate of a number of these disappeared citizens. Many families were still waiting to hear about their missing members. That's why the MKO TV claimed that more than 5 million Iraqi people have signed a petition calling for the MKO to be granted freedom of action in Iraq.
Yeah.
when the BBC called the petition a fraud. The organization sarcastically labeled the news network Ayatollah BBC. In a report commissioned by the Pentagon, RAND Corporation, a nonprofit institute, writes that the signatures are falsified. The 1991 uprisings in the South were suppressed with the help of the MKO. But their next mission in the North was much more horrifying. Rajavi's army, as the most equipped unit in Saddam Hussein's Greater Army, undertook a mission that later came to be known as the Anfal Genocide. Those who spend years in these prisons have not forgotten tortures by the Ba'ath interrogators. The 1991 uprisings in South Iraq broke out when the Ba'ath army had fallen apart after being defeated in the First Persian Gulf War. But with the great service the MKO provided Saddam Hussein with, by spying for the intelligence service and identifying the leaders of the uprisings, the popular movement soon came to an end. Once again, the Ba'ath army took control of the cities in South Iraq. Prisons became full of prisoners whose fate never came to light. The prisons of Basra and other southern cities were packed with prisoners who had been told on by MKO spies. But these prisoners were not the only victims of the MKO service to Saddam Hussein's regime. The total catastrophe for the Iraqi Kurds was on the way. A catastrophe caused again by this man and his organization, Mas'ud Rajavi and his organization called the MKO. A reportage prepared by the MKO TV states that South Iraq is under the control of rebels, alluding to the 1991 uprisings and the popular movements in that area. With the outbreak of the 1991 uprisings in the south, Kurdish fighters joined the rebellion against the Ba'ath regime. When the Ba'ath party had lost its power as a result of the defeat in the First Persian Gulf War, the fighters succeeded in controlling the heights and the Kurdish populated cities in the north. In addition, the Kurdish fighters managed to bring under control some areas in West Iraq. The streets of Khanarin were scattered with the bodies of the Ba'ath soldiers. The time was ripe for the fighters to go to Baghdad and topple the dictator. But in the absence of the Ba'ath army, there was an equipped army to block their way in North Baghdad. That army was nothing but the Mujahideen-e Khalq organization. The organization had been missioned to block the Kurds' way to the capital city before the complete suppression of the uprisings in the south and the arrival of Ba'ath reinforcements. On March 25, 1991, the Ba'ath military forces finally managed to completely suppress the popular movement in the South. After 2 weeks of bloodshed, and go to help the MKO. With their arrival, the military oppression against the Kurds began. It was called by Masoud Rajavi as Operation Pearl One, as it happened in the heights of the same name. Although the Kurdish fighters had been blocked on their way to Baghdad, they still had northern cities under control. At that time, the MKO had advanced on the heart of the Kurdish strongholds, and therefore had been surrounded by them. But when the Ba'ath army couldn't penetrate the Kurds, the MKO deceived them. In their own separate report, Australia's Parliamentary Committee on Foreign Relations and the U.S. State Department, as well as RAND Corporation, have revealed the role of Masoud Rajavi in the Anfal genocide and his help to keep Saddam Hussein in power. In its report, RAND refers to a statement by Rajavi encouraging the MKO forces to take the Kurds under your tanks and save your bullets for the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. Saddam Hussein gave Rajavi the Rafahdine Medallion, a high honor in the Iraqi military, for his role in suppressing the Kurds. The mass killing of the Kurds in the north resulted in the displacement of hundreds of thousands of the Kurds in these areas. Many Kurdish women and children lost their lives due to the cold, hunger, and difficulty of the situation. Many others went missing. A majority of them are still unaccounted for.
He could destroy Saddam and his army, but he don't try. All this because he don't want Kurdish and Shia to be leader in Iraq, to run Iraq. Why did he do that? He could destroy the army. We could live in peace. The war is finished. He destroyed Kuwait. Kuwait is 1 million. 1 million, he do this all war for 1 million. We are 5 million.
After the fall of Saddam Hussein in 2003, Iraqi prisons were the only hope for the families to find their missing members. Mass graves found in prison yards dashed the hopes of these families to find their long missing members. Suppressing, quelling the 1991 uprisings and playing a central role in the Anfal genocide, Masoud Rajavi helped the Iraqi dictator remain in power for another 12 years. In return, Saddam Hussein gave him a free rein in his territory.
Saddam's regime is over. Thank you.
in 2003. The Iraqi people saw a day when the country's dictator was finally arrested. He was put on trial for the mass killing of the Iraqi people and then sentenced to death. But no one asked about his right-hand man in committing crimes against the Iraqis. Masoud Rajavi disappeared in the chaos of falling Saddam Hussein.
هؤلاء يجب أن يلحقوا بهؤلاء ليس هناك ملفا آخرا إنما ملفهم مرتبط بملفات إجرام صدام وحزب البعث.
Rajavi knew well that Saddam Hussein's fate could be his. Camp Ashraf, November 2013. Long after the fall of Saddam Hussein, the MKO members remained in Camp Ashraf under the protection of the U.S. forces while trying to show legitimate their presence on the Iraqi soil. Now, years have passed. It's been years since the presence of Masoud Rajavi in Iraq, and Camp Ashraf has turned into a ghost city. The MKO members couldn't justify their presence in Iraq anymore. Evacuating the camp, they moved under the protection of the U.S. forces to a camp in Baghdad called Liberty, where their cost of living is paid out of the Iraqi people's pockets and where they live in complete security. Who knows? Perhaps Masoud Rajavi and his terrorist organization have been saved by the powers that be to be hired once again in the future.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
In Britain, former Chancellor of the Exchequer Rishi Sunak has warned Conservative Party members against fantasy economics. Sunak has pledged to slash taxes by 20% by the end of the decade in a last-gasp pitch to Conservative members, with the first ballot set to drop in the leadership race. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's chief political correspondent, Jessica Elgott. The piece is titled, Rishi Sunak Pledges 20% Tax Cut by End of Decade in Last Gasp Pitch to Members. Stay with us for more of Jessica Elgott's article. In Britain, former Chancellor of the Exchequer Rishi Sunak has warned Conservative Party members against fantasy economics. Sunak has pledged to slash taxes by 20% by the end of the decade in a last-gasp pitch to Conservative members, with the first ballot set to drop in the leadership race. But in one of his strongest attacks yet on the front-runner, Liz Truss, Rishi Sunak warned party members against an act of self-sabotage that could cost the party the election, and to be wary of major spending pledges and tax cuts, which he has previously dismissed as fantasy economics. I would urge them to treat with caution any vision that doesn't involve any difficult trade-offs, and remember that if something sounds too good to be true, then it probably is, he said. Simon Clark, the chief secretary to the Treasury, who worked under Sunak, said households could not afford to wait 7 years. Simon Clark, a key ally of Liz Truss, said, "Liz will cut taxes in 7 weeks, not 7 years. People are facing the biggest cost of living crisis in decades, and the tax burden is at its highest level in 70 years. The former Chancellor made the pledge having faced internal criticism from backers for his narrative of restraint versus Liz Truss's tax-cutting ambitions. In the announcement on the day party members will begin receiving their ballots, Rishi Sunak said he would cut the basic rate of income tax to 16 pence by the end of the next parliament, which he said would represent the largest cut to income tax in 30 years. Liz Truss, whose campaign gained the support Sunak's replacement as Chancellor Nadeem Zahawi on Sunday night, has said she will cut taxes on day one of becoming Prime Minister. She pledged to reverse the national insurance rise pushed through by Rishi Sunak in the Treasury, as well as halting the planned corporation tax rise next year, another Sunak proposal. Sunak has said he will cut income tax by 1% from 2024, a pledge made as Chancellor, but said his number one priority is to tackle inflation and getting borrowing under control. But on Monday, he said he would go further should the Conservative win re-election in 2024 and cut income tax down to 16 pence, costing around £6 billion a year. Sunak called the pledge the biggest income tax cut since Margaret Thatcher's government and said it was a realistic promise in the current economic climate. "I will never get taxes down in a way that just puts inflation up," he said, promising to always be honest about the challenges that we face. In a coded attack on Liz Truss, Sunak said the party's future in power was in peril. "Winning this leadership contest without levelling with people about what lies ahead would not only be dishonest, it would be an act of self-sabotage that condemns our party to defeat at the next general election and consigns us to a long period in opposition. I would urge them to treat with caution any vision that doesn't involve any difficult trade-offs, and remember that if something sounds too good to be true, then it probably is." Sunak's campaign said the 1p cuts would be paid for by increased Treasury receipts, while projected economic growth forecasted by the Office for Budgetary Responsibility. But the United Kingdom is still projected to experience the lowest growth in the G20, apart from Russia, and have the worst growth in the G7 at around 0.5%. Truss campaign source called the pledge another U-turn following Rishi Sunak's previous pledge to cut VAT on energy bills, a policy he rejected in office. He has also made it conditional on getting economic growth first, knowing full well that his corporation tax rises are contractionary, the source said. The public and Conservative Party members can see through these flip-flops and U-turns. Sunak's campaign hit back, saying it was not a U-turn and consistent with his pledge to to grip inflation, grow the economy, and then cut taxes. Liz Truss spent Sunday, 31st of July, in the southwest of England with a pledge to remove further regulation on farming without giving further specifics, but promising also a short-term expansion to the seasonal worker scheme. MPs backing Rishi Sunak have privately voiced fears that he will not have time to regain public momentum before members begin voting in the coming days. Though the contest is set to run until September, the majority of members are likely to cast their ballots in the coming days, immediately after they are received. MPs who have canvassed constituents say they believe the race is much closer than the public polling picture has suggested so far. Opinion polls by YouGov of Tory members put Liz Truss more than 20 percentage points ahead of her rival Rishi Sunak. But backers of Sunak pointed to an opinion poll of Tory councillors by Savanta Comres, which puts Liz Truss on 31% and Rishi Sunak on 29%. Around 32% were still undecided. One MP in a southeastern seat said the councillor polling was a much better indication of things and there was a significant amount to play for. In my constituency, Rishi is 60 to 40 ahead, and they love him in home counties. That is where the huge bulk of members are. In the north, there are barely any members. One senior MP backing Sunak, who had contacted over half of their members, said they were struck by the numbers of undecideds. The Liz Truss vote is soft and quite easily persuadable, they said, saying MPs needed to do more old-fashioned one-to-one lobbying if Sunak was to have a chance. Another who had polled their members said the vote was neck and neck and very soft. The MP said, "The YouGov opinion polls are normally accurate. I think Liz Truss will win, but I don't think it's all over yet." The Labour Party said the final pledges from the candidates were emblematic of a culture favouring headlines, stunts and division over practical policy plans. A Labour spokesman said, as the ballots drop, Conservative members will make their choice, but the sooner the whole country gets one, the better. Britain needs a fresh start with Labour.
Bazaar.
Whether man-made or not, food can have fascinating backstories. Products usually take a long journey before they end up on the dining table. Nevertheless, the food industry follows several golden rules that have helped it steadily grow over time. The most important of these is continuous product innovation and improved production processes to reduce costs and wastage. Others involve packaging and product accessibility, but probably the king of all rules is the taste that drives the food industry.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Bazaar, the weekly programme that analyses markets, profits, industries and all sorts of things that connect us nationally and internationally. This week we will be exploring the food industry and its related agricultural markets. We wanted to see how the food sector has expanded over the years and what companies are doing to increase their profits. So let's check out the Tasty Grub.
To become more familiar with how much work goes into food production, we visited Golha Food Industries. It was established nearly a century ago, and its products are now a household name. It produces hundreds of items in seven categories, such as dried legumes and fruit, spices and canned products. It also takes great pride in its healthy product line, including gluten-free flour products. This producer has devoted a lot of attention to the packaging of its products. Due to its diverse product list, it purchases such materials as cans, plastic, and cardboard to design the appropriate type of storage systems for distribution. The company has a massive daily output due to its expansive production facilities. Most of the work is done by automated machines, but the fine details are handled by experienced staff. All production processes start when raw material enters the company. These materials are first tested for quality before hitting the production floors, most of which are domestically supplied. After being tested, the material is sent to various closed circuit machines for processing. Then it is time for sorting and more quality control tests before packaging.
Food production is a very sensitive process requiring many checks and controls that guarantee the final product is safe for consumption. And production machines play an essential role as they reduce errors and maintain constant output results. Plus, many of these machines have been domestically engineered, whereas they were previously imported at high prices.
This company has a highly equipped quality control and research and development lab. It's where many new products are created and food safety standards are controlled. Moreover, the staff in this department implement food sciences to make innovative products. It might be interesting to know that this department also has some of the best food tasters. This producer has been awarded Best Research and Development Department in Food Production for many consecutive years. Among its many achievements, it has also been awarded the certificate of favored brand by customers. This wouldn't be possible without adhering to strict national and international food safety and production management standards. Following such standards has helped it maintain its export share in the global food market. With years of experience, this company has grown such that it provides thousands of employment opportunities, both directly and indirectly. It also has thousands of agencies and stores all over the country. Plus, its products can also be purchased online. As part of its future vision, this company is looking to increase its market share both domestically and abroad. It also has long-term plans to increase production and improve the production process for efficiency.
The Iranian food industry has taken giant strides away from its traditional production methods. Industry participants say using food sciences and new technologies has helped the food industry grow faster than before. Never more than now has food been more accessible. In fact, it only requires a touch of a few buttons to receive it at home. Therefore, food packaging is a critical part of the production.
Over the last decade, there has been a great emphasis on developing packaging for the food industry. This is because Iran indigenized many machines needed to process and produce food items such as deli meats, beverages, pickles, and so much more. Proper packaging also increases shelf life, which is important for consumers.
Previously, food items such as spices and dairy products were purchased bulk from customers abroad due to a lack of packaging. While exporting items in bulk has benefits, it's not as profitable as selling prepackaged foodstuff. So, in addition to adding value to raw products such as meat, companies have also designed attractive packaging to contain food in more manageable portions. Such a strategy increases not only product quality, but also food safety, which helps producers meet international export standards. This trend also helps companies with branding and has created job opportunities for designers.
As you probably already know, the food industry is heavily dependent on production in the agriculture sector. So it's no surprise that the agriculture sector holds the pulse of national food security and food exports. Plus, it is one of the only sectors that has been barely impacted by the US-imposed sanctions and the global coronavirus outbreak. That was horrible.
We looked at some figures from the Ministry of Agriculture to see how this sector is doing. Last year, around 6 million tons of agricultural and foodstuff products were exported. Trade of these products raked in roughly $4 billion. Pistachio, saffron, and confectionery products topped the export charts in value during that period. Other agriculture sectors, such as livestock, poultry, and aquaculture, have also generated millions of dollars in exports. Last year, nearly 450,000 tons of these items were sent to markets in neighboring regions worth $500 million. Agriculture accounts for 8% of the country's gross domestic product. It might be interesting to know that around half of Iran's total non-oil trade comes from this sector. That's all based on data from Iran's Ministry of Agriculture. According to Iran's Customs Administration, the total non-oil trade value rose nearly 40% last year. Over 120 million tons of non-oil products worth $72 billion were traded with other countries in that period. Meanwhile, the government has implemented measures to encourage the development of agriculture. One trend this sector is witnessing is the application of smart technologies for the cultivation and harvest of various products. There has also been a boom in developing greenhouses and green practices to preserve natural resources. The word plastic was initially used to describe pliable and easily shaped objects. However, it only recently became a name for a category of materials called polymers. Such materials are abundant in nature. Take cellulose, for example. It's the material that makes up the cell walls of plants. However, synthetic polymers are a more recent invention of the last 150 years. These come from the plentiful carbon atoms found in fossil fuels. Since then, they have become an integral part of the industry, technology, and even various sciences.
We will explore Iran's plastic and polymer productions. We will also check out some of its downstream markets and their contributions to the national economy. These days, we use more plastic than ever before. It's terrible. So where does this material come from? And what goes into making this stuff? Let's find out.
Our quest for answers led us to a company specializing in making various polymer products. Parsa Polymer Sharif was established some 20 years ago and is a knowledge-based company that was born in the research department of the University of Sharif. As a leading advanced polymer compound manufacturer, it makes various products essential to everyday living. It produces compounds based on commodity thermoplastic resins like PP, PE, and the famous PET, or PET. It also engineers resins like PVC and so much more. This knowledge-based company is a major supplier of raw materials to many industries. Some include original equipment manufacturers in the automotive market and PVC pipe producers in the construction industry. Over the years, this company has helped Iran save millions on products that would otherwise be imported. This firm has three main functions: research and development, innovation center, and production. It also has a brand new line for researching and producing biodegradable polymers for the packaging industry. Most of the raw materials needed for production are domestically purchased. When this stuff enters the company, it is first tested and graded based on its quality. Then, according to its intended use, the raw material is formulated and sent to machines for production.
Machines used in the polymer industry utilizes some of the most advanced machinery for production. The extruder is one of the most commonly used machines. They play a central role in plastic production. Extruder lines are the largest converters of plastics worldwide. Some of these machines can be domestically manufactured while others are still imported.
Its products are all tested in its well-equipped research and development lab. The various granules and resin compounds undergo over a dozen tests while being analyzed for quality here. Also, new product formulas are created in this highly technical research and development department. Through these facilities, the company is expanding its product portfolio. Products made here are produced along the lines of exports. So, national and international quality standards are implemented during the production processes. This means the quality of products found here doesn't just match international standards, they go beyond the quality of competing foreign brands in the international arena. The headquarters of this company is located in Sharif University Advanced Technologies Incubator. Owing to this, it has strong relations and collaborations with the scientific community. It has also been awarded for its contributions to the scientific and industrial sectors over the past years. This knowledge-based company also exports its products. The company has a unique future vision strongly intertwined with sustainable business development. This is partly due to its forward-thinking and social and environmental responsibility outlook.
Now, polymers are the primary materials that build many other products. Plastic items have different polymer formulations depending on their application. The majority of polymers made in Iran are domestically consumed. Some of its biggest customers are in the construction sector. Also, plastic is extensively used in the medical industry and transportation.
Almost everything around us is either made of plastic or has some plastic component. Moreover, plastic has played a central role in the development of the medical industry over the past 60 years. These materials are used to create hemodialysis machines, disposable needles, IV drips, and testing equipment vital to modern medicine. Plastics have also had a considerable impact on developing high-quality prosthetics. The National Medical Device Directorate estimates that Iran's share in the global medical device market will reach well over $7 billion in the next 3 years. PVC materials are also largely used in Iran's construction industry. For example, Iran's Doors and Windows Manufacturers Association estimates the domestic demand for PVC doors and windows is around 35,000 tons annually. This is partly due to the current residential construction boom in the country. The home appliance industry is also another mammoth customer of the polymer industry. Based on figures from the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade, Iran has doubled its production in this sector over the last 3 years. In 2021, around 15 million home appliance units were produced, with exports soaring to roughly $140 million. So, polymer production is key in expanding many manufacturing industries, which have raked in large amounts of foreign revenue for the country.
Well, I believe it is that time of the show where I should take a little break and pass the action over to my good friend and colleague out there on the field. Take it away.